From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, it's our Producer's Choice Edition, where we revisit some of our favorite interviews from the past year.
We'll start with a book on the music of the Vietnam War era and how songs had the power to unite people during a divisive time.
I think the fact that as a generation, whether you served or you stayed, whether you participated or you protested, you listened to these music, and that music drove the narrative of your life.
Then we learn how coffee farming practices can have an impact on global bird populations.
Trees of a certain height, as well as a coffee farm that has a certain number of tree species and a certain way to manage it, can provide fairly good habitat.
Plus, we'll take a trip to Anodyne Coffee Company and then have a conversation with Jamel Hill and Michael Smith, the new host-to-be of ESPN's SportsCenter.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We're listening back to some of our favorite interviews of the past year today, as chosen by the people who did them.
The Vietnam War marked a turning point in American history. The war took place during a time of turbulent social change. The 1960s and early 70s saw huge strides in women's rights and civil rights, but we also witnessed the assassinations of a president, a presidential hopeful, a civil rights icon, and the killing of unarmed protesters at Kent State by National Guardsmen.
Unlike most of the wars the U.S. fought before it, the Vietnam War divided rather than united the country, except when it came to the music. As Doug Bradley and Craig Warner show in their book, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, the soundtrack of the Vietnam War, music was the glue that connected us across race, class, and gender.
Bradley and Warner spoke about the book at Boswell Book Company back in February, but they first joined me by phone from their offices in Madison, and Bradley explained why Vietnam's soundtrack had the reach it did and still does.
Radio was our internet back then, Bonnie, and what it did was it connected us as a generation, and the music connected us. And we listened, pretty much all of us, to the same soundtrack. And that soundtrack went with us to Vietnam. It got played in Vietnam. It got covered by bands in Vietnam. It got brought over by the original artists who made the songs. And it was in our DNA. And I think the fact that as a generation, whether you served or you stayed, whether you participated or you protested, you listen to these music, and that music drove the narrative of your life. So what we found back when Craig and I started, you know, this odyssey, was that many vets still, because of the sad legacy of that war, never been able to talk about their experience. They could talk about a song. And in talking about a song, they were able to maybe get back home and talk about how the music connected them and sustained them and helped to heal them.
And the other thing about the music of that time is that country, soul, and various forms of rock and roll were equally powerful at the time, and they were listening to each other. Mm-hmm. So just as the Vietnam Army was in some ways the first truly desegregated army of the time, the music spoke to that, and spoke to that both to the tensions that could be within that and to the connections that that could forge. And it was just an amazing moment of musical call and response. The songs, the styles, speaking to one another, and people figuring out who they were with that music at the center.
The music of the time, too, was changing. When the Vietnam War first started in the early 60s, going until the end, you know, in 75, the music changed a great deal. And when you were talking to folks about what they remembered and what songs meant something to them, did you find that it changed depending on when they served?
Absolutely. And one thing we've always talked about, and that we, when we teach a course about this at UW-Madison, we remind students about the three W's for all veterans who were in Vietnam. And that's when you were there, where you were, and what you did. If you change any of those three dynamics, you've got a different experience, maybe even a bit of a different soundtrack. You change all three, I mean, it could be light years away. I mean, some of the guys we talked to from who had been in the military and were there as right after the advisors in the Gulf of Tonkin in 64 and 65, gee, to hear them talk about music and their experience as opposed to guys in 67 and 68 when you're getting into the thick of it with Tet and the heavy fighting. And then when I'm there, like 69, 70, 71, when nobody wanted to be the last GI killed in Vietnam and we think we're going home, it's radically different. And the music mirrored the changes that were going on. You know, we talk about how James Brown went from I Feel Good to I Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. You know, the Beach Boys went from Sloop John B to Good Vibrations. The Beatles. I mean, the music was just going through extraordinary change as well, and that had impact, but it also had resonance, and sometimes that's what you needed to hold on to.
The stories that the vets we spoke with tell in the book go from Pat Boone and the Kingston Trio to Steppenwolf, Gimme Shelter, and Sly and the Family Stones, there's a riot going on. And you really hear the world changing, and every one of those changes echoed in Vietnam.
Did you find that it depended not only on those three W's, but also the racial makeup of the GI? Or was it like you were saying earlier, there really was a cross that whites were listening to so-called black music like Motown, and that blacks were listening to what was might have been considered white rock and roll?
That's both. We found some soldiers who really formed their identity around racially specific music. We have black soldiers for whom Aretha Franklin was just theirs. But we also found white soldiers who claimed the Temptations, who claimed Aretha. We had a couple of black soldiers who learned to listen to country music at the time, despite the fact that at times that could become a flashpoint for racial tension. So it's a story that I think our book tells in something like its full complexity. Every time you make a generalization about what the music meant by race, you'll find somebody for whom it meant something different.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And also, Bonnie, another thing that was just really enlightening for me and one of those things that you forget, I grew up on the East Coast. You know, I thought I knew all kinds of music, although Craig still makes fun of me for not really knowing and understanding and liking country music. But
yep.
The guys we talked to who had their musical worlds opened up, who only ever listened to, you know, polka music or, you know, Pat Boone music. And because of the folks they fell in Vietnam and the exposure they had, you know, their whole, you know, canon of music changed, and they started to enjoy, you know, Cream and Mamas and the Papas and soul. It's a wonderful thing to see when folks come alive because of the music, and it makes them realize that they had connections they didn't know they had.
And one of the things that I like best about the book, that I'm proudest of about the book, is that it's not just a black-white story.
Right.
We interviewed a lot of Chicano veterans. I come from the Southwest. I was in a rock and roll band that had Chicano members in it at times. And we talked to people who said, hey, man, Santana could split the difference. If guys were angry about George Jones and James Brown playing, we put on Santana, and that was cool. And the Chicano vets tended not to break down into rock fans or soul fans. They were both. We talked to Native American veterans who dipped deeply into their tribes, their nations' musics, particularly when they came home and were looking for ways to heal and bring themselves back into the world.
Do you think that this kind of soundtrack during this particular time, will we ever see anything like this again where we can all go back and say, at that point, most of us were listening to whatever?
I think Vietnam was unique for the simple reason that it was a shared soundtrack. And now the technology has made it so that the men and women in the service can listen to their own music, which just fundamentally changes the way it plays.
Yeah, and our two TAs in our course at Madison are post-9/11 vets, and they both tell us that, of course, we'll always, all, as humans, we'll associate a song with an experience. But as Craig said, there's no broad sharing. They put on their iPods, they had their own set list, and that's what they have. It's not a shared one. But interestingly, they rally around and connect with our music, as many other Iraq and Afghan vets we've talked to. They talk about Hendrix, and they talk about the Beatles and the Stones, the music that we have. And the students that come into our class who were born in the mid to late 90s, this could be the Peloponnesian War, they know the music. So there's just, as Craig said, I don't think that's ever going to be captured that way again, to be as so much a thread in the mosaic of a generation. And because there were so many of us and the music was so doggone good, it's never gonna change.
And when you think about it, it's 50 years old.
Absolutely.
Neither one of us wants to talk about that.
Right. I'm sorry. Yeah, we'll cut that part out.
Of course. That music remains the center of what it meant to grow up then. I was 1 year younger than Vietnam. I spent a year thinking I was going to be drafted. But the band I played with played for the soldiers there. And we could go out there tomorrow and play the same set, and it would rock whatever club we were in.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this book. And it sounds funny to say that in a way, because it's about a time that was so horrible in so many ways.
Right?
But it was also an incredible time, too. And it was just an amazing time in our country's history.
Yes.
Yeah, and what the music did. And what makes, and I think we shot for this in the book. We worked hard to write a book that wasn't just a downer, because it could have been. And there are some hard, hard stories that we listened to and heard and passed on. But we also ended it with a mix, I think, of sadness and survival and healing. And the music was so crucial to that. And in a very real way, what we experienced as we wrote the book was being able to participate in the healing of men and women we talked to.
Doug Bradley and Craig Werner teach at UW-Madison and are the authors of We Gotta Get Out of This Place, the soundtrack of the Vietnam War. They spoke with us back in February.
Have you ever wondered how coffee is developed to be bird-friendly? Well, find out after the break. You are listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It's our producer's choice edition of the show today.
Bird-friendly coffee might sound like coffee brewed and developed for our feathered friends, but it's really a certification for what is more commonly referred to as shade-grown coffee. It's coffee grown using agroforestry, which encourages more biodiversity, including a variety of trees, small mammals, and, you guessed it, birds.
But the birds who make their homes in coffee fields throughout Central and South America aren't just locals. Many are migratory birds who may winter in coffee fields but spend their summers in the U.S.
Dr. Robert Rice is a research scientist with the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. Dr. Rice is actually a geographer, not an ornithologist, which makes his work with the center a little unusual.
He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about how he started working with the Migratory Bird Center.
I was offered this job not so much for my knowledge about birds, although I do like birds, but more for looking at land use and doing land use studies related to migratory bird habitat. So that's how we got to working with what we refer to as managed lands, lands that are mostly in agriculture. They also could be, you know, forested lands where people manage forests. But it's mainly agricultural lands, and the principal focus has been coffee, and coffee managed in a what people refer to as agroforestry systems. That is, you have coffee bushes on the land, but then shade trees of various heights covering them, providing shade, and all of that together creates a forest-like setting that we found, if it's managed in certain ways, can provide quite good quality and viable habitat for not just migratory birds, but for resident birds as well. You know, as an agricultural land, there are not many agricultural systems that can make those claims of being both economically active and productive and also having this environmental or habitat or biodiversity dimension to them. So we found that working in coffee has a lot of possibilities.
And that was sort of my question. Why coffee? How does what I've heard called shade-grown coffee, how does that affect the actual coffee plant?
Well, it helps, I think, to go back and sort of look at coffee evolutionarily. Coffee is a shrub native to what they call the center of origin, is located in what's now Ethiopia and the Sudan, in these mid-elevational, higher-elevation mountainous regions. And it's an understory shrub evolutionarily. So it's sort of been selected to live underneath a natural forest. So when people figured out that coffee could be a crop that could be grown for the beverage we know as coffee, many places actually tried to mimic its initial and historical setting by putting it into these agroforestry systems. For instance, when it was taken out of Africa and brought to the New World, that is the Western Hemisphere, in many places it was just inserted into forested areas. Other instances, it was put into areas that had been in other agricultural systems, so people had to plant shade. But early on in coffee's history, especially in this hemisphere, growers tried to mimic the natural setting of coffee with some kind of shade cover. But in more recent years, especially 30, 40, 50 years ago, when we were all benefits of what people refer to as the Green Revolution, some people thought coffee could be improved, and improved from the standpoint of higher yields, if the shade was taken away and you started to use different varieties, sometimes hybrid varieties, high-yielding varieties, and also using a lot of inputs like agrochemicals, whether it's fertilizers. And, of course, when you open it up to the sun like that, you also have weed problems, so you need to have herbicides to take care of the weeds. Those changes also result in certain diseases that come in, so you need pesticides. So there's a whole sort of host of things that have happened in those areas where coffee has been taken out of the shade and grown in the open sun.
So when they started growing coffee in the sun, were they right? Did they have higher yields?
Oh, yeah. No, it's very different, very striking, the yield differences. You can get to even sort of three times the amount of coffee per unit area if you open it up to the sun and use all these chemical inputs. But you really do have to sort of keep it on what some people would refer to as this life support system of chemical inputs, the fertilizers and the herbicides and pesticides and things. You do get higher yields. But it's also, I think it's a slight, not a misnomer, but it's in order to look at yields, you really need to look at the entire yields that come out of a agroforestry system. So coffee yields might be lower if coffee is grown in the shade, but for a grower, especially these small growers, and most coffee growers are small peasant producers, you have all these other crops coming out, or products coming out. You have firewood, of course, when the shade trees are pruned from time to time. You have construction materials from the trees that can be harvested every so often. You have, of course, fruits. You have citrus fruits. You have bananas. You have avocados. You have mangoes. Depending on what elevation the coffee's grown at, you have all this host of other products. So this array of other products has to be looked at, I think, when we're talking about yields. So you're going to have coffee, and you're going to have less coffee per unit area in a shade system compared to a sun system. But you're going to have all these other things as well. And much of that is very important to local communities and family budgets and, you know, family nutrition and even survival sometimes, especially when you're talking about very small producers of, you know, 1-2 hectares of land. These other products become very, very important, either for their own consumption or for trading or selling locally.
So what percentage of coffee would you say is actually grown in the shade versus in the sun?
Well, that is a very good question, and we've, you know, tried in various ways to figure that out and have actually written papers on it. Right now, I think for Latin America, which is where we mainly work, it may be something on the order of maybe 50 or 60% of the coffee area could be in the shade. But then there's a lot of kind of, I don't want to call it slop, but there's shade and then there's shade, right? In trying to figure out from different organizations or coffee research institutes around the region, they might call a coffee farm with, you know, a very scant number of shade trees in a system, they may call that shade. For us, we would say in order to be a real shade system that is actually protecting the soil and even providing habitat, there needs to be a diversity of trees, and the trees need to be a certain height, and the trees need to have a certain amount of foliage on them throughout the year in order to provide habitat for birds and other wildlife. So it's a hard number to come to, but good shade, probably 30-40% of the coffee in Latin America has some pretty good shade.
When we're talking about shade systems in general, are coffee farms who have a well-developed shade system, are those the farms that you consider bird-friendly?
Yes. In fact, from research done back in the 90s, we know now that trees of a certain height in a coffee farm, as well as a coffee farm that has a certain number of tree species and a certain way to manage it in terms of pruning and keeping the foliage there, can provide fairly good habitat. And we had studies that were done in coffee farms in Mexico, in Guatemala, and in Peru, where literally, I think, thousands of observations were done in order to determine what are the, what we would call, biophysical characteristics of a coffee farm, which ones are good for creating the habitat for birds. So once we figured that out, then we have created a list of criteria. We have checklists that we've created, and that has been handed over to a number of certification agencies who normally go and do organic certifications. But they now have this shade evaluation checklist that they can use if a farmer wants to be considered to be, quote, bird-friendly and receive the bird-friendly seal of approval, which goes along with our criteria, then they can be inspected and have their shade evaluated. And if it meets muster with the criteria that we created and they're certified organic, that's the first cut for us, then those farms can be, quote, bird-friendly. And that's all done with third parties, independent, both inspection and certification. We're not involved in that at all, but we did create the criteria, which is based on scientific fieldwork.
So why did you choose the moniker bird friendly? Because when I initially heard that, you know, I didn't really know what to make of it. I knew that shade-grown coffee was better for the earth, better for the environment in general, but bird friendly wouldn't be something that sticks out to me as saying that.
Well, yeah, you've hit on something that's very interesting, because we've had people say, well, what does that mean, bird friendly? Does that mean the birds like the coffee and they're eating the coffee? Or other people kind of go the other way and actually do get what we mean by it in terms of habitat. In fact, when I first heard the term, when I first came to work here, my former supervisor told me what he had done in terms of patented and trademarked the term. And to me, I thought, well, that sounds kind of strange. But as we talked about it, and I had worked in coffee quite a bit by then, but as we talked about it, he came at it from this habitat standpoint, started, you know, it made sense to me. So the term actually, it does need explaining, but what it is a shade coffee certification. Now, what's interesting is that bird friendly, that term, has worked very well in other countries. For example, in Japan, bird-friendly coffee is doing very well, and unbeknownst to us, the word friendly actually is a borrowed term from English that is used in Japan. You actually see it written on storefronts sometimes and in different places, the term friendly, for whatever reason. And of course, birds are a symbol of nature and are sort of deeply embedded into the Japanese psyche as such. So the term bird-friendly has actually worked quite well in Japan, and so we were happy with that, and Japan is doing quite well with the bird-friendly coffee.
That's very interesting, because here I don't hear the term used as much. How much of our coffee is bird-friendly certified?
Ooh, very, very little. If we looked at the entire amount in terms of world coffee produced, it's probably doesn't even get to be 1% of the coffee that's actually certified. From my own travels and talking with people, I think a lot more could be certified as bird-friendly, probably anywhere between 5 and 10%, maybe more. But right now, because we're still, you know, struggling with getting the market out there to recognize it as something that is viable and that consumers want, we're researchers, we're not marketers, we're still struggling to increase the demand as much as possible. So I would say a very small amount of the world's coffee is right now certified as bird-friendly. But as I said, I think a lot more could be if demand were to increase.
So if you're someone who is going to, you know, Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts, are you going to find any of this bird-friendly certified coffee?
You won't find it at Dunkin' Donuts. You won't find it at Starbucks. You won't find it labeled as such. It could be that they are actually buying and serving coffee that has the certification, but it's not going to be labeled as such because we have no agreements with them to use the logo and the term. But you will find it in Whole Food stores. And you can, of course, find it online, right, and order it that way. But I always suggest to people to get together with other people and order a fairly large order so that you're not buying 1 or 2 pounds and having to pay the shipping on 1 or 2 pounds of coffee. Rather, get people together and buy a big lot of it, and that way you split up the shipping cost. And also, when you order it or talk to your roaster ordering it online, make sure that you have them send it to you like a day after it's roasted. You don't want it to be, you know, sent 2 weeks after it's been roasted.
I think one of the big questions I had in looking at this is part of the research really focuses on migratory birds, who, of course, migrate, as their name might imply. How does shade-grown and bird-friendly certified coffee, how do those affect the birds that come here?
Well, it provides them, when they're in, say, Latin America, whether it's southern Mexico or into Costa Rica or even as, you know, far south as Colombia and Peru, these shade-grown coffee systems oftentimes are some of the last remaining canopy cover that they can find in the areas where they go. Birds do this thing. They have this thing called site fidelity when they go places. And they return to the same place year after year. And there's data from, you know, several studies that show that. And sometimes they return to the same place within 50 meters of where they were the year before. And all this has been done with birds that have been caught and banded so that you can identify an individual bird. And then the next year they've come back to the same place within 50 meters of where they were caught the year before. So if they're coming back to an area where it's been forested for years and there's coffee in the area and they've kind of hung out in the forest and gone to the coffee and used the coffee as a habitat as well, or maybe even the coffee is the habitat they've always used. If that then is cut down and transformed into something else, then they arrive there when they go to their wintering grounds and all of a sudden their habitat is totally changed. So they're then sort of put in a position of being more open to predation from predators, not having the food resources that they normally have because their habitat has been changed. They're looking around for other places. And so if we can keep these habitats intact, and it seems like to us that this bird-friendly certification helps growers keep it intact because they actually get a premium price for their coffee when they sell it as bird-friendly, then that keeps the shade coffee habitat in place and provides a place for these migratory birds to survive and then be ready to make the trip north again when the time comes. So it's just a maintaining of habitat and their overwintering grounds that can be very important to them.
So if we want a healthier ecosystem, if we want to see more birds in the spring, then it sort of behooves us to invest in this bird-friendly coffee.
I would certainly agree with that, and also tell your friends about it. And the thing is, I think our challenge right now is to increase demand for this coffee. And I think the best way that happens is for consumers themselves to insist on their coffee providers to find it. So if you have a local roaster that you like that is not carrying a bird-friendly coffee, just talk to them about it, and they can go online and find it, find the farms that produce it on our website. It's that kind of thing, I think, that's going to really start sort of working its way up the chain there for stores to start sourcing it more.
Dr. Robert Rice is a geographer and research scientist with the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center at the National Zoo in Washington. His work is on the intersection of agriculture and environmental change, with a special focus on migratory birds and coffee production.
We first spoke with him as part of our series on coffee that aired back in August. You can hear all of those segments at WUWM.com.
Keep listening. Our Producer's Choice show continues with the perfect complement to coffee, pizza. That's when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Back in August, Lake Effect featured a series focused on coffee in Milwaukee. We explored different companies, bakeries, and coffee shops to find out why our city loves to make and drink the dark brew.
Today for our Producer's Choice show, we travel back to Bayview to look in on one cafe that's undertaking an unusual pairing.
Some things are simply meant to go with your favorite morning beverage. Coffee and biscotti, coffee and cookies, coffee and breakfast foods, coffee and pizza. Yes, you heard me correctly. One Milwaukee company is delivering a unique experience to customers at Anodyne Bayview Cafe and Pizza.
My husband is very Italian. Really. We had a backyard pizza oven for a really long time. We as a family traveled a lot and traveled under the guise of eating, although don't tell my children that because they thought they were camping or on big adventures, but really for Matt and I it was always about food.
That's Lacey Perry, and the Matt she's referring to is her husband, Matthew McClutchie, owner of Anodyne Coffee Roasting Company. But other than a love of food and pizza, Anodyne found themselves with a large open space in their Bayview cafe 3 years ago after they moved their coffee roaster to a different location. Anodyne pizza chef Mira Downey says that it just didn't feel quite right to have people sitting where the roaster used to be. So they decided to bring a little bit of Italy to Milwaukee.
It didn't fit with like the cafe. And it's really nice to have something. When the roaster was here, there was the feeling, and now that there's an oven here, it's just really cool to have something alive that people that are in getting coffee can kind of peer in and look at and see what's happening.
It's very easy to see what's happening in Anodyne's oven. The 5,500-pound pizza oven, built from brick and mortar from Mount Vesuvius, is an obvious presence in the cafe. Perry says that they found a man in Naples, Italy, whose family tradition and business was making pizza ovens. The oven was custom built and shipped on a boat completely finished, making it a daunting task to install. But as Downey can attest, it was well worth it.
I didn't have much to do with the oven getting here, but I lived in Italy for about 6 years. And I was just in the cafe when I started working here, and then they said they were thinking about getting a pizza oven. And I said, okay, you're crazy people, that sounds fine. And then the oven showed up, and I want to play with that. Like,
she
that's
went all doe-eyed.
Doe-eyed.
For Anodyne, the same mentality and research that goes into sourcing and roasting their coffee goes into all of the components needed to make a classical Southern Italian pizza.
It's not necessarily ingredients that need to make it a Southern Italian. It's like a lack of complication that make it Italian. It's very simple. It's flour, salt, water, and yeast, and good toppings. And local, if you can get them. You know, the fresher things are, the more straight out of the earth they come. The more things you know how to do with what grows near you and flavors to combine and make good flavors, the better your pizza is going to be in the end. And that's the style of Neapolitan pizza. It's just simple and good and done right and enjoyed in good company. And that's what we're trying to do.
Part of what makes Anodyne's pizza authentic is the fact that the wood is the heat source. Every day at 10 a.m., a fire gets made to give the oven enough time to rise to 850 degrees.
At 10 a.m., you come in, you open the door, you brush out all the coals, and you build a little Lincoln log cabin of small pieces of wood, and you start a campfire. And then once it's big enough, you just push it back, and then you add to it until you get it hot enough.
Perry also notes that they are particular about the wood they source from the Milwaukee area.
And the wood is important because if it's wet or pops or sizzles, you can't necessarily get the oven to the temperature you want and keep it where you want it. So the wood comes from a number of different places. We kind of curate the wood and then take what we think is the best.
From grabbing the first dough ball to cutting a pizza, it takes about 3 or 4 minutes. And Downey notes that if the pizza is in the oven over 90 seconds, that's too long. Did you have a lot of trial and error when you were first doing this?
Just a little bit. We had a couple of days where we would just have 40 dough balls and, okay, make 10 pizzas and see what works and what doesn't and how much flour and how little flour and how hot the fire is and all of that. There's a million X factors, you know. If it rained on the day that we made the dough, it's different than it will be the next day if it was hot. It's amazing.
Since its first pizza came out of the oven, Anodyne has been attracting people near and far to their little piece of Italy.
We had people that drove all the way from Madison yesterday. They made a point. We came from Madison just for the pizza. All right, thanks. Okay, great. There's a gentleman that comes in with his son, and he is from Peru, but he's of Italian descent, so he usually goes to Italy once or twice a year, and he comes in here, and every time he's here, he likes to speak a little in Italian and ask how everybody's doing and ask what we're doing new in pizza. And he speaks in Italian the whole time, and every time he likes to say that he never thought he'd eat this kind of pizza in the States. And it's just nice to have people that will come from far to do that.
Lacey Perry admits that at first, coffee and pizza may not seem compatible. But it's the comfort that both can bring that makes the oven a natural fit for anodyne.
But there's something about, you know, coffee sort of brings a warm feeling to your belly. It wakes you up. And I mean, I personally still, after all these years, wake up thinking, oh yeah, coffee. Yay, I can have a cup of coffee. If I can saddle the children in and get there, I can have coffee. It's the same feeling with the oven, really, is that when 11:30 hits and lunch service starts, I know that there's going to be a warm, hot oven that's busting out good pizza. So it's sort of that same nurturing feeling that, that coffee has, in that it's sort of, it's very simple, the way coffee is simple. If you don't mistreat coffee, and if you're gentle to it, and you treat it well, it'll serve you well. Same with pizza.
For Lake Effect, I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
You can revisit all of the installments in our coffee series at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then a conversation with sports journalists Jamel Hill and Michael Smith, the new hosts of ESPN's Sports Center, starting next month anyway. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Last fall, the cable sports network ESPN announced that next month, the signature airtime of the network's signature show, SportsCenter, will get new hosts. Michael Smith and Jamel Hill have worked together as co-hosts of the sports and variety talk show His and Hers for the past 2 years. It is a show that began as a podcast.
The network says Smith and Hill will preside over a reimagined version of the show, which airs at 5 o'clock Central. The two were in Milwaukee this past spring to give the Axthelm Lecture in Sports Journalism at Marquette, and they came by the Lake Effect studio as well. Jamel Hill explained that His and Hers really evolved from the strong friendship that exists between the two hosts.
We both had a vision for how we want the show to be. And so it's very important to us, especially with our face and likeness in the show, that it really represent, you know, who we truly are. So for us, I mean, the people ask like, oh, what's your typical day like when you do the television show? And I'm like, well, it really doesn't end. I mean, it's a constant process of thinking about angles and stories and reading things. And so it's even as we're here now, I mean, we're still thinking about things that we may potentially talk about when we get back. So it is a nonstop, you know, process. And, you know, television for anybody who does it over a period of time, I mean, it's a grind. And every day you have to be on. We can't afford to come into a show and not perform.
There's never a moment where she's checked out on the show or she's mailing it in. And I like to think the same goes for me. And so, you know, our process is a lot different, and I say a lot more intense. And it's not to pat ourselves on the back. It's just that this is our baby. You know, we are not a couple, contrary to popular opinion. Never have been a couple. Maybe could have been in another life, but never have been a couple. Have not dated. I'm married with three kids. She is the apple of many a man's eye across the country. But this is our baby. And so our process is, you know, from the moment we open our eyes to, you know, the time we go to bed at night, we're constantly tinkering.
I've heard that you really try to steer clear of the term debate, though, the idea that you're debating. What turns you off about that term?
Where'd you hear that?
I may have done my research.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, he's got connections, I guess.
Yeah, wow. You take that one.
Well, it's not that debate is necessarily a dirty word, but we like to think that we really do pay attention to the nuance of discussions. It's sports, where sports talk is in general. It's like it's got to be a hero and a villain. It's got to be a right and a wrong. And sometimes it's just not that simple. And so I think for us, especially considering there's this perception that at ESPN that we do whatever we can to create debate and create controversy. And it's like, no, we like to have actual conversations. And so it's not that it's necessarily a dirty word, but I think given that we as a network have been criticized for certain commentary shows. I mean, I'll just say it because of First Take. People have had this idea that, you know, okay, this is the type of show that they want, and they are wildly successful. But, you know, they're in their own lane, and they've created that lane. And just because they have done that, that doesn't mean every single show that comes after that, or even some of the shows that preceded it, that doesn't mean that we're all following the same blueprint. You know, part of the reason why I think people were very hesitant about putting Mike and I together, or didn't see this as something that could be successful, is, you know, we're both around the same age, as he mentioned, African-American print journalists, our background, because aesthetically, we look like we would agree all the time. People thought that that's what kind of conversation we would have. And it turns out, as much as we're like-minded in terms of how we approach stories and other things, we disagree about a lot of things, you know, and it's not that, you know, we try to disagree, or we try to, you know, architect some debate, and,
right,
you know,
it's not, contrived.
It's not contrived at all. But there is room for, even in sports talk where you have to have a winner and a loser, we like to think there's a significant amount of room there left for layered, nuanced discussions.
I think debate just puts you in a box. For me, I don't like being compared to any other show, because there is no other show like ours. And there certainly is no other relationship like ours. There may be other people on our air or anybody else who have a nice chemistry. I'll take the Pepsi Challenge with anybody's chemistry, anybody's ability, anybody's versatility, anybody's sense of humor, timing, whatever you want to call it. So when people try to put us in that debate show box, I think it's selling us short for what we do. We have discussions. We tell jokes. We're very video-based.
We do skits.
we're part-time actors,
yeah.
Comedians. Our interviews are top-notch, we'd like to think. I mean, we certainly are growing and have room for improvement. But we don't just sit down and do battle to try to see who can be right, you know, because there is no right or wrong. There's only opinion. So, you know, somebody may agree with Jamel. That doesn't make them right, and vice versa. And that's not what it's about. We're not there to show one another up. We're not entering into an arena like gladiators. That's not what this is. And I think over the last few years, people in general, the viewer, has kind of gotten tired of the manufactured debate, the talking head, you know, saying things for the shock value. And I'm not necessarily pointing fingers at any particular individuals, but that's just not who we are. We're just Mike and Jamel, two fun-loving friends who like to have a good time with each other. And if that's your type of television show, join the party.
Well, let me ask you, what do you make of the criticism that a lot of the sports media gets, ESPN for sure, but not just ESPN, that you've been sort of complicit in creating a monster, that while the journalists might know there are things wrong with big-time sports, the networks are so wrapped up in it that they're not in a position to hold the league's feet to the fire to make the changes that are needed?
So glad you asked that question. One of the biggest misconceptions going. Now, look, are there high-level conversations that take place between network executives and league commissioners, lawyers, whoever, about coverage, about commentary? I'm sure. And maybe ours just hasn't been loud enough. I don't know. But I can tell you, nobody has ever come to us and tried to manipulate or discourage or, silence us on any issue. And I don't know of any other talent at ESPN that's actually dealt with it. I think people try to create martyrs out of some of our departed colleagues, and that's not the case. Like, nobody says you can't criticize Roger Goodell. There are people at ESPN, ourselves included, who have criticized Roger Goodell, who have criticized the NFL, who have criticized the NBA. We call it like we see it. If the day that somebody tries to tell us what we can and can't say, we'll find another place to work. Our objective is just to always be fair. Now, if the viewer doesn't think that we are going as hard as they would like at a certain individual or entity, maybe that's because we don't see it that way. But we're not afraid. We don't pull any punches when it comes to our commentary on anybody across the sports landscape. Yeah, do we make for strange bedfellows when we have broadcasting rights with you know, every network, every sports league and colleges and what have you? Yeah, absolutely. And I can see why the conflict of interest would come into question. But that has not trickled down to us. Now, again, maybe the powers that be aren't listening closely enough. I don't know. Right. But we've never felt like, oh, we can't say that because, you know, we're Disney and or, you know, the NFL, we have Monday Night Football, so they might get mad. It's never crossed our mind.
Yeah, and the conversations that do make their way to us, they're usually just about things you would have in any newsroom about responsibility and fairness.
Mm-hmm. Accuracy.
And accuracy, yeah. Like, which takes place all the time. I think especially these days, as I like to call them, the outrage police, they're constantly handing out tickets to people. And I think a lot of it is that ESPN is low hanging fruit. And viewers, I think they're sometimes, they are probably confused by our roles because they have the broadcast partners on one end and we televise these games and we play a lot of money for them. And then you have the journalistic arm and then you have the entertainment arm. And those hats are constantly, you know, switching. Mike and I laugh all the time and joke that we're former journalists. I mean, we're always journalists, but we do realize that part of our job every day at noon, Eastern, that is, ESPN2, is to entertain people.
That's the E in ESPN.
Exactly. And so, but that doesn't make us less accurate or less fair. Like, those journalistic principles that we were raised on still mean, you know, quite a bit to us. And so I think a lot of it is just people just have this idea built up in their minds about how things operate there. And it couldn't really, in most cases, be further from the truth.
People are also very lazy, quite honestly. And by that, I mean a lot of the critics. And a lot of the critics, whether they're in mainstream media or social media, actually just don't do their research. Now, I'm not even talking about coming to Bristol and interviewing people. I'm talking about watching television. Because one of our pet peeves, I know I rail about it all the time, is when somebody says, well, nobody knows who that is, or nobody's talking about this. No, you just haven't heard it.
Right.
Because if you're going out and saying, well, nobody at ESPN, why isn't anybody talking about this? Because people can fire off a tweet with no accountability. People, Jamel and I would both say, well, you must have missed the show today when we discussed this.
Right.
And the latest example, prime example, there was a big controversy. You know, our friend and colleague, Bomani Jones, wore a polarizing, controversial, but rather clever Caucasians t-shirt. It was a takeoff of the Cleveland Indians on Friday. We talked about it in our show, gave it props, laughed at the controversy it caused. We gave it two thumbs up. We immediately get, oh, ESPN told y'all not to talk about the t-shirt?
Like, you clearly didn't watch the show,
yeah,
because
I mean,
we did.
You know, but people, so I'm saying that that's just a microcosm of a larger issue where people paint ESPN with this broad brush, like we're all saying the same things all the time. I think it's a product of just being so massive.
You get the feeling that a lot of people are walking around with their own personal focus groups, and if they don't hear them,
there
focus
you
groups,
go. Yes.
Yeah, that's
yes.
The perfect way to put it.
Who do you think you're most trying to reach with His and Hers? I mean, you're on at noon, and
yeah.
You know, we're having this conversation in the studio. Our show airs at 10. It's
mm-hmm.
It's sort of a strange wilderness in the middle of the day.
Big time.
Who's paying attention?
Well, you know what? That's interesting you say that because I mentioned a time slot earlier when we follow, you know, First Take on ESPN2 now. Or even just being on ESPN2, which is obviously, you know, not in as many homes, doesn't have the same reach as ESPN. I think technology has alleviated that concern in many respects because it feels like we have a pretty significant DVR crowd.
Yeah.
Both our original podcast and the show is available on iTunes, like, and on ESPN.com and on the app immediately after the show. So we're more accessible than that noon to 1 hour. Our biggest fight that we've had to battle lately is the disassociation with YouTube. Now, like, no more ESPN content is available on YouTube. That really hurt us because we were able to put our stuff, you know, on the internet for people to see in case they missed it. We both have pretty healthy Twitter account following, so we'll post clips and videos from the show. We're not going to reach the same amount of people as we would if we were in the afternoons on ESPN naturally. But I think slowly but surely the word is getting out that we are the best 60 minutes of your day. And if you're not at home and able to catch it at noon, then you can catch the re-air in the afternoons a lot of days. You could DVR it. But a lot of people watch it at work or in class.
Yeah.
We're not condoning that kind of thing.
But we're not necessarily discouraging
but
it either.
We like to think we make it worth your while,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, and it is, there are certain challenges that you face. And for us, I think the relevancy of the show is where we make our sort of biggest, where we've made such a huge jump. It's like,
yep,
people know the show. They may not always get to see it every day. And as Mike mentioned off air, it's like, look, when you go meet the president of the United States and he knows your show,
right,
then I'm good with whatever the ratings say.
We kind of answered the how many are we reaching, but you asked the who are we reaching. And we don't know who that looks like. I mean, because we like to think we appeal to everybody. Mm-hmm. Now,
You know, have some certain demographic information.
Well, I was about to say that the casual person will just on the surface say, oh, well, you know, you're two black people, so you must appeal to black people. Well, I would like to think so, but we're not limited to just appealing to black people. Our conversations, while they may come from an African-American perspective, can certainly be appealing to all races, all ages. Like, we skew younger, there's a maturity to us where adults, they may not get all of our current references, but it's not like our conversations are immature by any stretch. I mean, I think we're respected in that space as well.
Have you thought of subtitles for your older viewers?
Well, you know what?
It's funny.
And that's kind of what I'm getting at and what Jamel's talking about. It's like a long time ago, we stopped concerning ourselves with, you know, appealing to everybody. You understand? We want to do that naturally. So we're not trying to be all things to all people is what I'm getting at. We want to be the best that we can be for the people who watch our show. You know, I don't know how many people actually noticed this that watch the show, but we scrapped introductions a long time ago. We no longer say, welcome to His and Hers. I'm Michael Smith. She's Jamel Hill. We immediately start the conversation the moment the show starts. And part of the reason we do that is, hey, if you're tuning into this show, you already know who we are. And if you don't, you'll find out very quickly. But it's very much a club. And it's a party. And will we like more people at our party? Sure. But we also realize, as Jamel mentioned earlier, we're not everybody's cup of tea, so everybody's not going to want to come to our party. So the only people we're concerned about having enough food for, enough good music for, enough, you know, comfortable space for, is the people who come to the party. We're not trying to evolve or change who we are or how we talk about sports or the references we make or how we do things to accommodate a larger audience. We're worried about the fans and serving the fans that we do have. So we're worried about who are we trying to reach? The people who get it.
Yeah, it's an analogy I think we've heard before around ESPN. Are you trying to be McDonald's, a billion served? Or are you okay with being the critically acclaimed restaurant on the corner?
The hamburger joint.
The
right?
hamburger joint where you can only get this type of burger at this place and you love it and you'll keep coming back, but it won't be billion served. So it's like, but I think that's not unusual for any show.
Right.
Because there are times when I watch Chris Berman and I don't get anything he's saying. Right. But nobody's telling him to stop it. And for the people that love Chris Berman, it works.
At this point, we can't worry about the people who don't get us. You know what I mean? The people who do, they really do.
And if you're not McDonald's, at least you're not Chipotle.
There's that
too. See, I take that as a sign of disrespect.
I've always told her that it goes Moe's, Qdoba, Chipotle in my
range. I told him he's wrong.
Yeah.
Although I can't win the argument now given all the controversy
that
around
Chipotle. That was kind of where I was going.
I was like, I can't win that argument.
Well, Michael Smith, Jamel Hill, thank you so much.
No, I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
And, you know, our show ends at 11, so people can turn off their radios and go straight to their TV.
Yes.
Jamel Hill and Michael Smith are, for now, co-hosts of His and Hers on ESPN2, but beginning in February, the day following the Super Bowl, they'll take over as new hosts of ESPN's flagship SportsCenter show, which airs at 5 p.m. Central Time.
We first spoke with them last April when they were in town to speak at Marquette University. And that is today's Producer's Choice edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.